you're going to start to see much larger swings to the downside, because once these stocks get technically exhausted or something happens, something's said on an earnings call that the market doesn't like, and you see a large drop. Right now, for the last few quarters, you've seen the NVIDIAs of the world rise 20% after earnings just about every single time. It's been flawless. But what happens when it goes to the other side? You can easily see a 5 to 10% pullback in the market in the S&P 500 if those stocks start to underperform. So I think we're cautiously bullish, and I think we're definitely looking to play downside as we go into Q2, Q3, Q4, even as the election approaches. I don't think that the euphoric sentiment we see now is going to be nearly as strong into the end of the year.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart. The headline economic data gives a comforting sense that the economy's strong. And the media headlines tell us that the consumer is, quote, resilient. But if you ask most Americans, they'll tell you they're struggling. Last year, a Forbes advisor survey revealed that nearly 70% of respondents either identified as living paycheck to paycheck, or even more concerning, reported that their income doesn't even cover their standard expenses. So why is there such a big disconnect here? For context, we're fortunate to talk today with Adam Cabasi, publisher of the popular capital markets report, The Cabasi Letter. Adam, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
Total pleasure. I think this is your first time appearing on the Thoughtful Money channel, even though we've done interviews in the past. Welcome to the new program. Thanks so much for coming on. Congrats with all the success you've been having recently in the financial media. I see in a lot of places. It's very well deserved, and I you know, want to give you your due props for you know, I see you as representative of part of the new generation of financial thinkers coming in here. You're a younger guy. This is a space that generally tends to be dominated by a lot of old gray-haired people, and I'm certainly getting my own fair share of it here. It's really nice to see younger guys and bright minds like yourself coming in and picking up the torch.
Yeah, no, it's great to, I think, you know, bringing in the newer generation of people into finance too, we kind of bring a different perspective. I think that's kind of something that's allowed my work to stand out, is just bringing in new perspectives. I very kind of imply old school methods like fundamental analysis and new stuff like technicals, kind of combine the best of both worlds, which has been very profitable over the last 9 years. Now we're going on 9 years of running the Cabasi Letter.
Wow. I hadn't realized it had been almost a decade. Well, congratulations. Yeah. Maybe you're not as young as I thought you were. Just kidding. All right, my friend. Well, look, lots to talk about. I'm sure we're going to pull up some of your company's great charts along the way here too. I want to get to that kind of main sort of disconnect between what we're hearing, but what people are feeling in their real lives. But before we get into the details of that, let me just start with the general question I like to kick these discussions off with. What's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Yeah, so I think you hinted at it pretty well at the beginning. I think right now, if you were to ask 10 different people, how is the economy? How is you know, your day-to-day life? Every single person would have a completely different answer. And I think that kind of summarizes it. Right now, you have, you know, markets are trading like we are in complete euphoria. Absolutely nothing is wrong. New all-time highs. I think we've seen over 30 new all-time highs in 2024 already. Maybe it was 40, actually. And the economic data is pretty strong. I mean, you have very strong job growth. You have a strong labor market that's been pretty tight now with record low unemployment. Inflation data is starting to tick up again, but you're still seeing, you know, retail sales came in strong today. So it's the economy seems strong from that perspective. But then on the other hand, you see these reports where, for example, housing affordability is at all-time low. Mortgage demand is the lowest since 1995. You have food prices up significantly. We put out this chart comparing CPI versus fast food prices over the last 10 years. McDonald's prices have doubled while CPI is up 40%. So there's a lot of categories that have seen very high inflation. Most Americans are not saving money. Most Americans have a lot of credit card debt with record high credit card rates. And right now it's kind of like, you know, the economy is strong on paper, but in reality, a lot of people would say otherwise. And I think that's why the wealth gap has really widened, especially since the pandemic with the recent surge in asset prices.
Okay. So we've got this environment where, you talk to the markets and the folks that are publishing the economic data, everything is awesome. I think you said complete euphoria. You talk to regular people, it sounds like you're saying kind of everybody tells a different story at this point, right? So very heterogeneous at the moment. I want to dig more into that because I have a particular suspicion that as the dust begins to settle, that it might be we see that there's a small number of people, the already wealthy, doing very well, and kind of like the bottom 80%+ doing worse as time goes on. But yep. I don't necessarily want to force you to have that same conclusion. But real quick, just on the market, so that's sort of on the economy side. On the market side, you briefly mentioned that lots of all-time highs. Obviously, Q1 was a barn burner quarter. Q2, it's certainly more volatile so far. What's your general sense of the markets right now?
Yeah, so we have, in our work, we've been pretty bullish. Our subscribers have been long this market, actually the entirety of this year. And really starting in late November, we started switching to the bullish thesis. And it's incredible. The S&P has added 1,000 points in basically 5 to 6 months. That's 25%. I mean, that's 2.5 times the average annual return of the S&P added in 5 months. And if you were to look at the backdrop during that time, you wouldn't really necessarily think it's that conducive for a rally of that size. I mean, you've had rate cuts priced out, you have geopolitical tensions, you have basically every headwind that you can possibly ask for. Inflation's back on the rise, all these things, but the market just keeps going higher. And that was something that we kind of identified early on. When I say early on, I mean early on over the last 5 to 6 months, because mm-hmm. our thesis was the market still, and right now it's still the case, all it cares about is AI hype, euphoria, big tech getting bigger. And if that's not the kind of trend that we were looking to fight going into 2024, I think you saw in every earnings season now, you see these large tech companies saying what the investors want to hear. I mean, you have stock buybacks, Meta issued a dividend, which added 20%. You have Nvidia saying demand still exceeds supply. And as long as that remains the case, it's a very tough market to fight. And clearly the market's attention has shifted from the Fed being the number one and sole driver to AI and the Fed kind of competing now with the move higher. And I think that's something that now, a lot of this has been priced in. People are starting to say, maybe we should shift back more towards the Fed. Maybe we've gone a little bit too far too fast. But even then, I mean, the technical uptrend hasn't broken. So we haven't necessarily taken a huge short position. We're just kind of trading these more midterm swings to both directions.
Okay. So yeah, it sounds like you're saying, there's been a hype juggernaut, and you don't want to stand in front of that juggernaut when it's got momentum behind it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a key point, because a lot of the time, if you can attempt to call a top in the market so many times, right? And when you do call the exact top, maybe one out of however many times, it's going to be very profitable. But the reality is every other time that you don't call that top, not only are you losing, but you're missing out on that move higher. And our view at, with our work and everything that we trade is play the trend until that trend is over, and then play the other trend, which is the new trend that just formed to the other side. Because even if that means you miss out on the first 5% to either direction or even less, you're not necessarily just catching a falling knife or trying to time the exact top. And I think that's really what's allowed our work to stand out and perform pretty well the last few years.
Okay. And I'm not trying to oversimplify your approach here, but it sounds like momentum is a big part of what you guys look at, right?
Absolutely.
You don't want to stand in, you don't want to be in opposition of the momentum, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
So there's the old saying that the market, can be irrational. longer than you can remain insolvent. And I'm guessing that's sort of a part of your unwillingness to try to call it top and whatnot is just, hey, as long as it's moving, you know, we're going
right.
to not stand in
yeah,
this
I mean,
way.
At the end of the day, the market is never quote unquote wrong, right? It's always right. Like, even if you believe the market is completely irrational, it's going up while we're pricing out rate cuts, it's going up while every headwind in the world is happening. The market is right at the end of the day, because you have to trade the market you have, not the market you want. And that's really the basis, the very simple basis behind everything that we do investment related.
Okay. With that being the case, the question I just want to ask is let's say compared to a few months ago, right? How concerned are you right now that the market is in irrational territory or overly exuberant territory, or euphoric territory, to use your term? Are we in danger of having pulled too much future valuation into today's prices? You also mm-hmm. mentioned that there are a ton of, you know, risks out there, and we'll probably talk about several of them. But just sort of your threat meter here, right? Or your risk meter. Like, I understand you're not going to stand in front of the trend until it clearly reverses.
Right.
But, you know, as you're looking at it, are you increasingly worried, or do you feel like, nah, yeah, we've seen this before, it's not that bad?
I would categorize our view as cautiously bullish, from initially being very bullish before this whole rally started a few months ago, primarily because it still seems like the market, it's almost in denial of the fact that inflation's back on the rise. It's almost in denial of the fact that rate cuts are being priced out. And it's almost giving too much credit to big tech, right? And right now you have the top 10% of stocks in the S&P are 75% of the market, of the index by market cap. So is what you see right now is, yeah, those top 10% of stocks are performing great. They are effective in the market, and they're kind of ignoring all the noise happening elsewhere. But at the same time, how long can that party last, right? You can only, I mean, NVIDIA can't become, I don't even want to say this, but it can't become a $10 trillion company this year. But, you know, I mean, I guess I'll never say never anymore, but you know what I mean? They can only go so far, so fast. And I think that's why you're going to start to see much larger swings to the downside, because once these stocks get technically exhausted, or something happens, something's said on an earnings call that the market doesn't like, and you see a large drop. Right now, for the last few quarters, you've seen the NVIDIAs of the world rise 20% after earnings just about every single time. It's been flawless. But what happens when it goes to the other side? You can easily see a 5 to 10% pullback in the market in the S&P 500 if those stocks start to underperform. So I think we're cautiously bullish, and I think we're definitely looking to play downside as we go into Q2, Q3, Q4, even as the election approaches. I don't think that the euphoric sentiment we see now is going to be nearly as strong into the end of the year.
Okay. So a couple of quick things. One, your transition from very bullish, we'll say at the very beginning of the year, to cautiously bullish now, really closely mirrors what Darius Dale, what his outlook is. And I mentioned this just because I just interviewed Darius, that video just released this past weekend. And I just want to connect some dots here. You know, when I see patterns, I like to flag it for the audience here. So you're not the only guy thinking this way. Time will tell who's really got the right outlook, but you got another smart guy in your camp there. I'm going to pull up a chart that you just recently published, or at least you shared on your Twitter, which is related to a comment you just made a moment ago, which is, this is showing this sort of alligator jaws gap, or divergence, we'll say, that's opened up pretty much since the start of the year between mm-hmm. the price of the S&P, right, which we just talked about, has had a great Q1, but the market's expectations for rate cuts. You know, most folks remember coming into the year, I think the market it was one point pricing like 7 cuts in, right, and that's now been walked down to less than 3. And you can see that at least starting, you know, in the data series here from middle of last year, that correlation between those two data sets tends to be very, very tight. But since the beginning of this year, they've had a massive divergence. So when you talk about an increasing probability of swings to the downside, I'm guessing this is one of the things that's factoring into that prediction, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's just strange. It's gold and the S&P 500 are both kind of in this camp together, where they're just moving in a straight line higher, completely ignoring the relationship we've seen over the last 2 years and over the last 50 years. I mean, it's almost always been, and you know, rate cuts are I guess in the when you're in the process of a rate cut cycle, markets have moved with rate cut expectations. So now that we're seeing pullback in rate cut expectations, literally no sign of a pullback in S&P 500. And I think right now, that's why I said the markets are kind of in this phase of denial. Their markets are saying, okay, we've had a couple. So first we had, you know, 1 month of rising CPI, PPI data. And everyone was like, maybe this is just a speed bump. We're not necessarily reversing the trend. Now we have 2 months. It'll be interesting to see what happens if this becomes 3-4 months of reacceleration and year over year inflation readings, because then at that point, I think you might start to question if we see rate cuts at all this year. I think 3 rate cuts is now starting to sound very optimistic. I wouldn't be surprised if the Fed starts to lean more towards 2 or less in their guidance as we go into the May, June, and July Fed meetings.
All right. And so here, I guess the question that I have on this is, you know, while that divergence really started beginning of this year, it's not new. You know, like 2023 largely was a year that at every moment the market was basically saying it expected the Fed to pivot. Yeah. And Powell had to keep coming back on month after month after month and tell folks, nope, higher for longer. Nope, I'm committed to the 2% target. We got to get inflation down further. And every time they were playing chicken, the market had to be the one to blink and move its expectations back. And yet we had, you know, a great 2023 in the markets. It didn't really impact prices that much. Didn't slow them down. And it's certainly not at all this year. So I guess the big question is like, what's going to cause it to matter? And maybe it's right. One of those unknowables, but I'm just curious if you have any theses on that.
Well, I think, you know, first going to your point of the whole market versus the Powell situation, this, it just feels like deja vu every 3-4 months now, right? Like we go from higher for longer to Fed pivot, back to higher for longer, back to Fed pivot. Like, I mean, this must have happened at least 10 times since they started raising rates. And the interesting part of this whole thing, there was a point when the markets aligned with Powell, like both saying we're going to see a Fed pivot. This was in December when we started seeing that 7 rate cut case priced in. And I remember after that Fed meeting in December, it almost felt like a victory speech from Powell. He was saying, you know, inflation is down. We're looking at cutting rates next year. And that was the first time prior to that, they kept saying no rate cuts. And then I remember just talking.
Sorry to interrupt, but they were saying, we're not even talking about rate cuts.
Exactly.
And then 2 weeks later, it was like, oh, by the way, we're going to do them. Yeah.
Right. It was literally 2 weeks later, because I remember at the end of November, he said it's quote unquote premature to be thinking about rate cuts now. So I remember talking to like a bunch of people in the industry, and everyone was just puzzled. Like, I mean, it just came out of nowhere. All the market just kept pushing higher. All risky assets went to all-time highs. You saw even crypto, Bitcoin went above 70,000. It was just a complete party. And then everyone was kind of like, the Fed was having this view for the last 2 years that we'd rather wait too long to cut than cut too soon. And now it's the exact opposite. And then now we're right back to where we were, you know, premature to start thinking about rate cuts type talk. And it's kind of come full circle. So at what point does it start mattering? I think that point is coming soon. I think maybe after the May Fed meeting, markets will start to say, okay, maybe the Fed really isn't going to start cutting rates as soon as we expected. And I honestly don't think that we will see a rate cut at this point until September. If the inflation data starts improving, I mean, if we take a complete U-turn here and it goes right back down, then maybe you see one in July. But I definitely don't see rate cuts starting over the next couple of months, which would be before that July meeting. There's 2 meetings prior to that. And I think that's markets are going to soon start to say this matters. And even if that doesn't mean we have a crash in the market, which I'm not necessarily calling for a crash, that might mean that we have a near-term kind of peak or cap as to how high we can go. And we just kind of trade range bound. Because even right now, we've been below all-time highs for the last few weeks. There hasn't been a new all-time high. So we're even now we're seeing that kind of range bound trade as markets are trying to figure out what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And wow, we haven't seen a new all-time high for, you know, a couple of weeks. It feels, you know, like unusual now that we're not hitting a new all-time high week after week, just because we've gotten so used to it now, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think this was the market move. The market just posted, like, I think it was its third red week of the year. So it's been all green the whole year, which is incredible to think about.
And do you, is it too early to say that this looks like maybe like a rally that's petering out?
Yeah, I mean, I still maintain our, you know, the view that I said earlier that I'm not necessarily trying to call the top. I think it's a good time to start at least reducing exposure. If you have these, if you're in these tech stocks or you're in these high beta names that are up 90% year to date, it never hurts to manage your risk or hedge. But I don't necessarily think that we're going into some huge crash event at this point. So it's a bit too early to start saying, to start calling for, you know, a major correction in our view.
Okay. All right. So back to the Fed for a second. I want to ask you for your own outlook on inflation. Because I find of all the experts that I interview on this channel right now, this is the question where I see the greatest diversion. I've got a good chunk of people that think, hey, inflation's sticky. And, you know, lots of secular reasons, reshoring, you know, rising cost of oil, that type of stuff, that's going to keep, you know, wage inflation, that's going to keep, you know, inflation higher, you know, for a good long, you know, higher for longer inflation, right? We're in a new regime where it's just going to be higher than what we've been used to, right? And a number of those arguments are compelling. But similarly, on the other side, there are a lot of compelling arguments that inflation will get back to 2%, and maybe even some that argue it could very well go below. These are people like, you know, the Lacey Hunts of the world, the Steve Hankeys, who are looking at money supply, and money supply has been shrinking. And, you know, these guys have, you know, decades of experience. They've got the formulas of economics on their side, you know, quantity value of money, stuff like that. Basically say, hey, when the money supply declines like this, and when there's also net national negative savings like we have right now, economic history is really clear. You know, you go into deflation. So I'm curious, do you have a strong position one way or the other?
I think there is a long-term path back to 2% inflation. Like, I don't think we're, and especially because the Fed has maintained this view, right? Like, they're, so many times people have asked, would you consider raising your inflation target to 3%? And then that kind of would feed into that other camp that you're talking about. But I think if policy remains restrictive for long enough, and even if that meant raising rates further, if it came down to it, if there was another major surge in inflation for whatever reason, I think there is a path back down to 2% inflation. What I will say is that doesn't mean that we're going to undo all the inflation that we've seen over the last few years here, right? So there's this
cost of living's not coming down.
Absolutely not. There's this notion out there that once inflation's at 2%, the grass is greener, everybody go outside, go for a run, there's no problems anymore. No, I mean, it's not prices, even at 2% inflation, prices are not coming down. So that's a clear point to differentiate here. So I think we can get the rate of inflation down to 2%. Do we see deflation? I think right now that's a very tough ask. I think if we were to see it, a couple of years ago, you could have called for a case for deflation if the Fed really raised rates even quicker and kind of kept them higher for longer. Now it just kind of feels like you're trying to get down to 2%. Once you get there, you don't cut rates too much, but you cut them just enough to maintain that steady state. And if you overswing to the downside, I don't think anyone would complain about that at this point. But I think there is a long-term path to 2%.
Okay. And when you say long-term, and, you know, this isn't an ironclad prediction, but yeah, you think in by the end of the year, you thinking 3 years?
Not by the end of the year. I think it will take at least until the end of 2025 to get core inflation down to 2%. And headline inflation down to 2%, will take at least another year and a half to 2 years. And we'll probably, I mean, we've seen the drop from 9% to 4% was very fast, But I mean, I've said this so many times, and this was actually why we went short TLT, which tracks bonds, at the beginning of this year. It's going from 4% inflation to 2% is going to be a lot harder than it was from going from 9% to 4%. Just because of the way, you know, you mentioned wages, there's inflation entrenchment in wages. There's all the commodity price stuff that's happening right now, supply side inflation, which is a whole nother can of worms that the Fed can't even control. And they're trying to kind of compensate for in demand side policy. Those kind of factors, I don't see coming down in a straight line over the next year or so.
So let me ask you this. So I ask this question a lot, but I'd love your thoughts on it, which is the lag effect, right? So you know, in general, you know, what you're saying about inflation, where the, you know, getting from 9 to 4 wasn't a problem, but getting from 4 to 2 is a lot harder. I mean, that's, in many ways, that's just sort of the universal Pareto rule, right? Where the first 80% requires 20% of the effort, the remaining 20% requires 80% of the effort, right? And the longer that we are higher for longer, right? The longer that Powell is prevented from bringing interest rates down because he needs them higher to help get that sticky inflation down, it just weighs, that higher cost of debt weighs heavier and heavier on the economy, right?
Yeah.
And so how concerned, if at all, are you about the lag effect? Because I'm not picking a side here, but one of the things that the disinflation camp, or maybe even deflation camp, has on its side is the potential of a recession.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. There's been this talk about the lag effect now, probably for the last year, right? Everyone was saying, and if you were to go back to September of 2023, people were saying with the lag effect, we're at 2% inflation, or we're near 2%. Now we're eight months later, and we're at close to above 3, approaching 4 again. And I think if you look at financial conditions now, they're actually easier. They're less restrictive now than when the Fed started raising rates.
When the Fed started. Yeah, I know.
Right. So, and I think a lot of this has to do with a lot of consumers are currently in forms of debt that have mortgage rates or interest rates that are way below current rates, right? Like 90% of borrowers have a mortgage below 5%. A lot of these auto loans that were issued in 2021, 2022 are, you know, half the current interest rates. And I think those people...
But those auto loans are also much higher because the price of cars went bananas, right?
Absolutely,
We've seen all those TikToks of the guy who's got a, you know, $1,100 monthly payment on his car,
yeah. Right? Well, and that's the point, that I think there is a lag effect in a way, but I don't think it's as immediate as people are saying, because of these forms of debt are much longer. You know, you're not talking about credit card debt, which obviously is at all-time high, but...
We're going to get there, yeah, too. All-time high with all-time high rates, yeah.
Yeah. But, and you know what's interesting, too? We've published a lot of work on this. This doesn't get as much attention as it should, but I think the person or the entity that needs lower rates more than anyone, literally more than anyone in the world, is the U.S. government itself,
mm-hmm.
Which may be part of the reason why we're seeing such a push towards rate cuts every single, you know, quarter or whatever it may be, because debt service costs have more than doubled. Annualized interest expense on U.S. debt is well above $1 trillion now. We're going to see well above $1 trillion this year. We could see $1.5 trillion this year if rates don't come down. And borrowing, I mean, everyone see the headlines, right? We're taking on $1 trillion every 90 days. When you're borrowing at that level and deficit spending is that high, you need lower rates than anyone else. And I think that's what the U.S. government got used to over the last 20 years. We are in an unprecedented time of low rates. Now we're paying for that era of quote unquote free money, and it's quickly catching up with us. So I think the U.S. government itself could use lower rates even more than the citizens and the consumers of the country.
All right. So I still want to get to our, you know, bifurcation of the economy and the bottom 80%, you know, perhaps having a real tough time going forward. But you're opening up a great can of worms here, we'll say, because you're combining a lot of things I think are really interesting. So you're saying, well, the lag effect, you know, it's taking its time, and it has, no doubt. And I think a big reason for that, at least based upon a lot of my discussions on this channel, has been the positive net liquidity that's been flowing into the system really in force ever since October of 2022, which, by the way, is when the markets bottomed and then everything took off to the races, right? Mm-hmm. And that rush of new liquidity has been accompanied with, you know, a ton of debt issuance. You know, we're now doing $1 trillion every 100 days. And with and what's interesting is we kind of have this tug of war, I guess, between the monetary side now and the fiscal side now, where the Fed is at least with rate hikes and QT jamming on the brakes, but the fiscal side has been spending so much that it's been winning out, right?
Absolutely.
Like you said, financial conditions are looser than they were when the Fed started, and the Fed isn't, you know, it's not blameless here. It's done things like drain the reverse repo program, which adds liquidity in the system, right? But I think to a certain extent, the Fed's got to be looking at the Treasury and Congress and saying, dudes, come on, what are you doing? Like,
yeah,
you're already doing all my
effort. They've already hinted at that, right? I mean, how many times Powell said we're on an unsustainable fiscal path, but at the same time, it's not his job to determine how Congress spends their money. So they're kind of caught up in the middle of it too.
Yeah. And I think it's clear. And some of the people I talk to who know the Fed better than the average person are saying, hey, you know, I don't think there's any love right these days between Powell and Yellen. But anyway, the lag effect's been either slowed down and it is going to arrive at some point, and showing my cards, that's kind of where I place the probabilities. But I think the market and other people are thinking, it's hasn't shown up, it's not going to show up, right? Mm-hmm. But to your point about, you know, when I sort of talk about the risks of higher for longer and the lag effect that could drop, you know, you've got the corporate maturity debt wall coming up. You've got these households that, sure, maybe you're sitting on a cheap mortgage rate, but if you've got revolving debt, that's more expensive than it's ever been. Cost of home ownership has gone up. So even if you've got a low percent mortgage, just your cash flows that you're spending out just to maintain your house and pay your insurance and stuff like that, that's all going up. So all that stuff sort of weighing on key elements of the economy. But you're bringing up something really important, which is, hey, maybe it's the government that's feeling the pressure the most. And I think, you know, a lot of people look at Powell talking about rate cuts and say, why are we cutting? Right? We've got stock market at all-time highs. We've got strong GDP growth. We've got low unemployment. Like, why would you cut in an environment like this? Cuts are supposed to be, you know, kind of an emergency measure. If anything, we should be maybe thinking about hiking rates here because we got to get inflation under control.
I think what you're saying is hits the nail on the head. If the Fed is calling for a soft landing while saying we need to cut interest rates at the same exact time, it doesn't make any sense. Why? If the economy is so strong and everyone is doing so well, why do you need rate cuts? Why do you even need to rush to rate cuts? Why not just wait until inflation is at 2%? Even if there is a lag effect, the data is strong. And I think there's also a disconnect in that logic there.
So this is the question I wanted to ask you and get your opinion on. So when Powell switched, when he surprised everybody back in December, right?
Yep.
He was giving, as you said, almost a mission accomplished speech, right? And he even said, we don't want to say mission accomplished, but kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge, we're feeling pretty confident. And when we don't want to wait until CPI drops to 2%, because then there'll be momentum behind that and then inflation will get too low. And like you said, I don't think any people listening to this would cry tears if that happened, but the Fed doesn't want that for whatever reason, right? But a lot of people, and some on this channel with me, you know, ask the question, well, is he confident or is this fear? Is he worried about something that he's not telling us and he's trying to get out ahead of it with, you know, with these rate cuts? And he's just packaging it in this, hey, we're almost done with our job narrative, but he's actually trying to, you know, get ahead of some potential crisis that he sees coming. And before you answer, I just want to pull in this other key point, which is, I think, you know, there's a lot of people that say we're now in an era of fiscal dominance. And in fiscal dominance, basically, it means the debt issuance gets so big that you have a real problem of servicing that debt. And to service that debt, the Fed has to give up its mandate to control inflation just to get the debt under control. And maybe that's what's going on, to your point. That's sort of the larger point I was trying to work up here with this whole diatribe. But like, is maybe what we're looking at here is Powell saying, I've got to start cutting to get the cost of that debt under control. And you know what? If I got to sacrifice inflation for it, I'm not going to say it publicly, but if I have to, I got to, because if that debt pile begins collapsing, then that's the whole ballgame.
Yeah. I'm going to start with the second part of that first. I don't think we're at that point yet. I still think the Fed is committed to their mandate right now. I think they want maximum employment, price stability. I think that's what they're looking at. I do think in the back of their head, they had this little voice telling them, if it's not going to be me, it's going to be the next Fed that's going to have to deal with this. And it's going to be a problem at some point. So we might as well get ahead of it now. But at the same time, our hands are tied, right? Because we do monetary policy, not fiscal policy. That in itself is a whole podcast we could talk about. But yeah. I want to go back to what you said at first about the December victory speech, which I'm still puzzled by this whole thing. If you look at a chart of the financial conditions, the amount they eased directly after that, it almost like there was almost a rate cut. Like the market basically took that as a rate cut, or more than one rate cut. Even though they didn't cut rates, if everybody, you know, if you ask anyone in the markets business, the Fed's word is even more powerful than when they actually implement a cut or a hike or any sort of policy. Where as soon as they say they're going to do something, markets price it in almost instantly, right? So it's just puzzling. And I think Powell has done a great job on many things, but the two things that I think history will remember the most are first saying that inflation was transitory, which may have ended up being one of the worst Fed calls in history. And then second, this victory speech in December, when seemingly everything was finally starting to go right, they took a complete 180. And I still can't understand why that happened. It doesn't make any sense. Within weeks of that, you had Fed members coming out saying, you know what, maybe not even weeks, actually days later, saying maybe we spoke too soon, maybe markets are overreacting, and they tried to backpedal. But at that point, it was already too late. And maybe that's really why we're starting to see another surge of inflation. Financial conditions right now are not as tight as Fed policy suggests they are on paper. And it's hard to understand why that happened. But I think right now we're really starting to pay the price for that.
We may be. I mean, the thing I'll note is that Powell has had many opportunities since to walk things back or restate or manage expectations down, and he hasn't. I mean, he's basically still said, we still think we're going to have 3 rate cuts. You know, I'm not guaranteeing it, but I still think we are, right? What he's doing, we just don't know exactly what it is.
And the interesting part about that is a lot of the Fed voting members are, I mean, we had like 13 Fed speakers over the next week. I mean, there's a new Fed speaker every hour, it seems. It's like a reality TV show. And they all say it's too soon to cut rates. And then the meeting comes around, the dot plot comes, and there's like a unanimous decision every single time what they're doing, when rate cuts are coming. The whole committee says rate cuts are coming. It's very confusing why it almost feels like the Fed's putting on this unified front type of thing. And then once they get out of that meeting, everyone just goes off on their own. They go speak at different places and give completely different opinions. And this has been something I've pointed out many times, even when they're raising rates, there's so much public disagreement between the Fed. It almost confuses everybody. Like, you don't even know what's going on anymore. One day we're cutting, one day we're hiking, one day we're doing nothing. I think the Fed could do a much better job kind of communicating and aligning expectations, or at least managing expectations, even if they are divided, because it just leaves everybody very confused about what's coming next.
So I hate to play the age card, but I think you're too young to really remember the speeches by Alan Greenspan, who was the master of trying to keep everybody guessing. I mean, that guy could talk for an hour and he would get off stage and be like, what did he say? Right. And it was very intentional. He just didn't want anyone to really feel like they knew what was going on.
Maybe that's what's happening here, honestly.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Maybe it is intentional like that. It's a deliberate smokescreen.
Just leave all possibilities out there. They could go hike at the next meeting, and you know what? We said we would. I mean, I don't know.
Right. Well, and Powell, you know, has been very, he's been very consistent about, no matter what he says, but hey, you know, we could do the opposite. Like, he's, you know, we're being data driven. We're taking the data as it comes, right? All these caveats.
There's always a hedge.
Yeah, there's always a hedge. So one thing I just want to note for you and viewers that haven't seen it, 2 weeks ago, I did what I consider to be maybe one of the most important interviews I've yet done in my career with former Kansas City Fed CEO Thomas Hoenig, who was famously kind of the rogue member of the FOMC during the Great Financial Crisis, who was the lone dissenting voice when they were voting to do QE. And the reason why that video, I think, is so important, that interview is so important, is because, you know, we can all speculate what it's like inside the Fed and how they make decisions. He's actually sat at the table and so actually knows how it works. And very sadly, I mean, much to his credit, I was so appreciative. He answered every question I asked him, like, very specifically and clearly. But sadly, it really did validate a lot of my concerns about the Fed decision-making process. It does sound like there is a lot of dysfunction there. It does sound like there's a lot of political pressure that influences the Fed decision-making coming from DC, coming from Wall Street. It seems like those are the voices that are loudest in the Fed's ears when it's around the tables, you know, making its decisions. So all these things about being, you know, independent and super data-driven and whatnot, it does not seem like that's the case. And in many cases in a crisis, you know, Hoenig was saying, you know, the mechanism there is really, well, let's act now and then we'll, so that we're doing something, and then let's figure out over time how to actually make it work, right? Wow. So yeah. It was, like I said, it was sad and somewhat depressing to hear those fears, I think many of us have, be validated by a guy who's actually been there in the inner circle. Okay, but with that said, we don't know what the Fed's going to do. I guess we're just going to have to take this one thing at a time. I guess last question for you on this topic is, we do have the Fed jawboning cuts, right? And you said, you know, they act to a certain extent almost as rate cuts, or in certain cases, maybe even more than rate cuts. We have the fiscal side of things still continuing for the foreseeable future to spend. And of course, we have an election coming up, right? So I'm sure there's a ton of political pressure on the fiscal side of things to keep the party going until folks get into the voting booths. How much of all this do you think is going to be damn the torpedoes, do whatever it takes just to keep things happy through the election?
Yeah, so it's an interesting point, because there is a lot of pressure. I'm sure there's a lot of pressure for rate cuts, right, on the political side. But at the same time, especially now with social media and the ease of access to information, I think everybody is talking about inflation, right? And everybody kind of hears about the headlines, oh, inflation's back on the rise. They might not know the exact specifics, but most people know prices are rising. They go to the grocery store and the same items they bought in 2020 were now 40% more. And that's a fact. The Wall Street Journal put out a study. The same exact items that you would buy for $100 are now $140 in 4 years, less than 4 years. Wow. And people see that, right? And I think the thing that that's kind of contradicts itself is, well, yeah, you want rate cuts so that everyone can feel like the economy is starting to come back, but then inflation is going to get worse, right? And then those same people, you might upset those same people you're trying to please, right? So it's like, it's kind of a double-edged sword here. And I think, you know, you will probably see some political pressure, but I hope that the Fed will just do as best as they can to remain objective, regardless of what anybody wants, maintain their mandate. And I mean, that's really all we can do. It's only so much we can control when it comes to that.
Yeah. Well, let me just interject for 1 second. So personally, I feel like no matter what the Fed does, it's not really going to matter. Like, the Fed could announce rate cuts tomorrow, but there's a lag, right? There is a lag effect with monetary policy. So we're probably not going to see the impact in the economy of those rate cuts by the election. Now, we will see an impact in interest rate sensitive assets, and those things will probably pop, but that doesn't help the majority of voters who are angry about cost of living, because most of them don't own that many financial assets. In fact, if anything, it probably makes them angrier that the rich are getting even richer here. So I'm not sure the monetary policy lever can do that much between now and the election, though. If you feel different, I'd love to hear it.
But the fiscal the next term, the next few years, I mean, it will, and I guess at that point, you know, there'll be different objectives with, you know, the political game. Yep. But it's not in the long-term benefit of anyone to just start cutting rates for the sake of an election, which I don't need to tell you, of course. Yep. That's more of my point.
Okay. But I do, I guess I'm curious if you have any thoughts on just the fiscal side of things. Are they just going to keep trying to shove money out there to the election?
I think so. I mean, the last debt ceiling crisis, which was, and we're coming up in almost a year ago, which is incredible, was ended in June of last year when we almost defaulted. Everyone saw all the headlines. And what people don't realize is the debt ceiling is effectively uncapped until January 1st, 2025. This year, we could borrow as much money as you want. It does not matter. Go to 40 trillion, go to 45 trillion, whatever it may be, borrow the money. And look, we're already on track for, we've already, if we sustain the current rate, we might hit a $3 trillion deficit this year, assuming we're in the soft landing scenario. That's the most hysterical part of all this to me. And I've tweeted this so many times. All these projections assume we're on track for a soft landing. What happens if a recession actually hit? And I don't even want to think about what would happen, but I don't see any reason why spending is going to cut back. I mean, you see these $1 trillion bills are going through every month now. I don't see in the immediate future any motivation or reason at all that these that spending will dial back. And I think there's really a big kind of misalignment here in incentives, right? I think a lot of the people that are voting on these bills and spending this money have the incentive of maintaining their, you know, their, I guess, their spot in Congress or whatever it may be, maintaining making their people happy. But that's not necessarily what's best for the United States over the next 30, 50, 100 years, right? Those are two different things. And until those incentives align, I don't really see why anything is going to change unless we're forced to change.
Okay. So I'm right there with you, especially on that last point, which is it seems hard to imagine the status quo changing proactively, right? It's only Absolutely. Until it's forced to. I spent a lot of time talking to this channel how there's a lot of elements of our status quo that are both unfair, can maybe talk about that a little bit in a minute, but also just unsustainable. The problem is again, you know, we're likely not to change our behavior until it becomes so painful to try to continue the status quo, right? And you're assuming that you're, from your comments and your nodding head here, that you feel similarly. So, all right, so let's now get to this point where, you know, we have everything that's going on right now. It's increasingly working only for a fewer and fewer amount of people. You said, you know, you don't even want to think about what would happen if a recession were to hit, right? So a couple questions on that. I want to note here that right now we have net negative savings of Americans as a percent of gross national income were negative during all of 2023. In the past, there were only two times when the net savings share of gross national income were negative. Want to know when they were? Great financial crisis and the COVID crisis, right? So yeah. This is one yet another recessionary indicator that we have, like these long and inverted yield curves and stuff like that. And we can pull up a lot of other data that's sort of in recessionary territory, where you look at those and say, huh, by this chart, looks like we should be in or near recession. But then you look at, you know, GDP, or you look at unemployment, and they look great, right? So kind of like your alligator jaws earlier, you know, there's some of these data sets out there where we're like, okay, one of them is going to have to win out at some point in time here, right?
Sure.
I want to just ask you, because in your intro, you said economy strong, right? How strong do you think the economy really is? Like, and maybe let's look at a couple components. Like, let's look at the unemployment numbers. And I'm sure you've seen a lot of the questions that get, you know, come out every time the latest payrolls data comes out and people look at, you know, the headline number, but then they look at all the revisions and they look below the hood and they say, oh, there's a lot of things here to be concerned about. Do you feel like we're the employment market like really is as strong as we're being sold, or do you have concerns?
I don't think so. Okay. I think how you can categorize where we are right now is we're kind of just running on momentum. Okay. And it's not sustainable, but we're still running. And what do I mean by that? Well, a lot of the effects of inflation are being offset by credit card debt, right? That's why credit card debt is going up so fast. Americans are fighting, quote unquote, fighting credit inflation with credit card debt. A lot of these job gains, Yeah, over last year, I saw this stat. I don't think we've had net gain in full-time jobs over last year, while part-time jobs have are at record highs. So there's a record number of Americans working more than one job to maintain their life. I mean, that is by no means strong, right? It's strong on paper. The data is strong, but it's not strong when you go ask the average person, how are you doing today? How is affordability for you? How are you able to pay the bills? Are you able to, all that stuff is not strong. So I think the momentum can keep running, and I think that can run for longer than most people expect. But I do think eventually, yeah, we're going to go into a recession. And if you ask me within the next 5 years, do we see a recession? My answer would be yes. If you ask me within the next 6 months, do we see a recession? My answer would be no. And I just think that, especially if the Fed starts cutting rates, I think those things that are driving the momentum can kind of last a bit longer than most people are expecting.
Okay. All right. So two last things as we begin to wrap up. I could go like another 3 hours with you, Adam. So we're just going to have you back on here. To this point about the bifurcating economy, right, where it's doing great for a smaller number of people, and more people are, basically living on, increasingly expensive debt right now, as you just said. How worried are you about this from just sort of like a societal sustainability standpoint? And how do you think this resolves? Does the situation keep getting worse given the trajectory, or do you see some sign for optimism here that maybe it's actually going to get better?
Yeah, I mean, look, I always want to be the optimist, right? Like, I always want to say the US is in a perpetual bull market if you zoom out far enough. I think the people are very resilient. They're more resilient than people think they are. And I hope that we're able to kind of get back more towards normalcy, have affordability come back a little bit. Maybe we'll see housing prices pull back a little bit, allow some of the newer generations and millennials to get into homes. But I don't think that happens over the near term. It's very hard to see a case where things take a sudden turn in the opposite direction, unless something quote unquote breaks. But even right now, that's not looking to be the case. And look, I mean, a lot of the measures of inflation over the near term, like look at commodity prices. I mean, we haven't even talked about commodities much, but that's a big focus for us here too. We trade all the major commodities. You see these charts of cocoa prices or oil prices or olive oil or orange juice. All these random inputs are outperforming walls like hedge funds. Like these are like the best performing assets on the street. You think Nvidia is up a lot? Go pull up the chart of cocoa prices. Like these random things, and obviously there's more than just inflation involved, but those do pressure inflation. I think OPEC's committed to higher prices, so I think over the short term, it's a lot of the factors that are driving inflation are here to stay. And I do think affordability continues to get worse, but I hope beyond that, maybe as we go, 2, 3 years out, things start to improve, especially if we can get s inflation sustainably lower. So time will tell. I wish I had a crystal ball.
Okay, so just you don't need a crystal ball, but just put on your optimist's goggles here, right? Put on your rose-colored glasses, right? So, if we get to this future where inflation moderates, right, which means these input costs have to come down, right? And by the way, cocoa traders making a ton, right? But the average person who's going to buy stuff, olive oil, at the store, it's just adding to that, $40, 40% increase in over 4 years, right? In the cost of living that you mentioned. In the scenario that doesn't involve like a big recession clearing event that brings prices down and somehow magically without destroying incomes at the same time, so that people can afford things like housing more. What drives this? Something's going to have to drive incremental economic growth in a way where more people have greater growth in real wages. Mind you, in an era where AI is continuing to permeate into the workforce and whatnot, and will hopefully help people be more productive versus eat away at the job stack, right?
It's tough to think of an exact scenario. I think you do need, I mean, the simple answer, the in a utopian society, it would be wage growth outpaces inflation for X amount of years or months or whatever it may take to make wages realigned with current price levels, and then people can kind of afford things like they could afford prior to all this money printing and madness we've had. I don't know if that happens. I think what really happens is, like I said, over the near term, we kind of maintain this course. And then once we have that kind of something that breaks, you see a recession that causes prices to pull back. You see a correction, you see real estate prices come down. And that's another thing we didn't even talk about, but even commercial real estate, residential real estate and commercial real estate are the definition of the moving in opposite directions right now. So something breaks and kind of causes general price levels to pull back. And at that point, you may even see deflation. You probably will see deflation in the next recession, just like we saw in the financial crisis. And I'm not calling for a financial crisis, just to be clear, but it's you see a similar type of trend because it's other than that, there's so many moving parts here that are not aligned. It's hard to imagine a case where just wages go up and everything else stays flat and we're right back to normal, you know? And look, I think also we talked about it a lot, but getting government spending back down and just getting on a more sustainable fiscal path is the one of the first steps in that. Because right now we are spending, I mean, it's just incredible. We are spending at above World War II levels on a percentage of GDP. Deficit spending is above World War II levels as a percentage of GDP. So to everyone who says, oh, inflation adjusted deficit or this and that, the dollar today is not the same as it was 100 years ago. We're talking about as a percentage of GDP, spending has never been higher. And that in itself is a source of inflation.
So I'm glad you mentioned that. I beat that drum a lot, that we're basically running a wartime economy in peacetime right now, right? When, quote unquote, everything's great, economy strong, consumer resilient, unemployment low, et cetera, right? So you just wonder, God, what are our deficits going to be like if we did indeed fall into a recession, right? I mean, they'd just be eye bleeding, right? Yeah. All right. Well, look, I appreciate you going through this mental exercise with me because look, I don't want to, you know, I like to be an optimist as well, but it's hard for me given, you know, the things you mentioned. Okay, we have to see real wage growth outpace inflation for a prolonged period of time. You know, if you look at what's happening right now, inflation is remaining sticky. And yes, we finally have had some positive real wage growth over the past year after 2 years of negative, right? But now that wage growth is moderating. Right. So that's not really going in the right direction. And then your other thing about, well, we're just going to need to get our fiscal spending, you know, in order, get that realigned. I'm like, all right, great. I'm not holding my breath for that one. I know about you. Right. So these aren't things where I'm like the current trend and the current decision making isn't making me super optimistic around this. All right. So in wrapping up here. Given all this outlook, you say you're still cautiously bullish, at least here at this point in April of 2024. When you look out, so let's say sort of the rest of the year, what do you expect from the markets? And right now, given current conditions, what positioning do you think is worthwhile for investors to consider? What are you guys recommending?
Yeah. So, first I will say our outlook, it could very well change tomorrow because it's just been so volatile. And I think that's kind of one of the value adds of our, the service that we offer. Is we're always looking at the technical backdrop, we're always looking at the fundamental backdrop and making sure that the two align. Whenever there's a misalignment, that in our view is a trade opportunity, right? And so I think what we've been doing is, we're trading stocks, but we're also trading the commodities, we're trading bonds, we're trading these other markets that have seen incredible amounts of volatility. I mean, look at the 10-year, it's about 4.6% again. That is a huge move. So what we've been kind of positioning is, how we've been positioning our subscribers and our portfolio is diversify within these different markets, like trade the commodities. We've trading oil and gold and natural gas has been very profitable this year, while still maintaining that cautiously bullish outlook in the S&P 500. We've been buying the dips, trading some of the near term swings, and I think that remains our thesis into the year end. I think we could see continued strength in the equity markets, at least into Q3, and then as you start approaching the election, we're going to be a lot more cautious, maybe not even take a necessarily take a stand and or a view to either direction and more just trade the volatility, because right now that's where the money is. So I think we continue to drift higher, but the swings are very tradable, and that's what we've been doing.
All right. You know, you're reminding me that there was a whole other topic I wanted to talk about with you, which we'll have to reserve for next time. which is comment you made relatively recently that we're perhaps seeing the end of the 40-plus year bond market run. And I'm sure there's all sorts of really interesting implications for that. And I hate to end on a giant teaser like that, but it's unfair to try to talk about that in, you know, the remaining minute we have here. But Adam, this has been great for folks that have really appreciated this conversation. Maybe for some of them, it's the first time they've gotten exposure to you and your thinking. Where can they go to learn more about you and your work?
Yeah, so we publish a lot of stuff on Twitter, on X, sorry, at Kobeisi Letter. That's Kobeisi Letter. And then we also, our main, most of our work is posted on the KobeisiLetter.com, which is our service that I've been talking about. We publish a weekly report with our trades. We publish chart of the week with like a specific asset we're looking at and we're trading. And then even our subscribers get access to this daily feed where we're updating positions, we're posting charts, we're commenting on new headlines, and we're trading anything from stocks to commodities to bonds and even some Bitcoin now we're trading, as well as options. And all of our analysis is our historical performance is on our website, so we're 100% transparent. And our goal is just to outperform the S&P 500 and help as many people as possible in that process to learn about this great market we have that's become even more profitable over the years with the increase in volatility. So I urge everyone to kind of check out our work and see if you're interested in it.
All right. Well, I absolutely second that. A couple of things. One, when I edit this, Adam, I will put up the links to those resources prominently on the screen so folks know where to go. Folks, the links will also be in the description below this video. For viewers that heard me mention the release of the new service on my Substack called Macro Pass, where premium subscribers are getting that rotating selection of premium reports from many of the experts that appear on this channel. Adam has just very kindly agreed to join that faculty. So we'll be adding the Kobeisi Letter to that rotation. All right. So Adam, I've got one last question for you, which I'm going to give you about 30 seconds to think through as I do a quick little bit of set of housekeeping here. And that is, we've been talking about financial issues and money-related issues this whole conversation so far. What's one non-monetary related investment that you would encourage folks to consider adopting in their lives? And while you think about that, folks, if you've enjoyed having Adam on and would like to have him come back on again soon, especially to dig into those many other important topics we didn't get a chance to discuss in this discussion, please let him know by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And just a reminder, information only has value if you put it into action in your life. So for, you know, taking any action on the insights that Adam and I have talked about here, if you read his newsletter or that of the other experts that come on this channel and want to put those things into practice in your own portfolio, unless you're an experienced DIY investor, highly recommend that you work under the guidance of a good professional financial advisor who takes into account all the issues that we've talked about here. If you've got a good one, stick with them. If you don't, consider scheduling a free consultation with one of the ones that Thoughtful Money endorses. These are the guys you see with me on the channel every week. To do that, just go fill out the short form at thoughtfulmoney.com. Also at Thoughtful Money is where you can sign up for our free newsletter or upgrade to the premium service that gets my notes and the macro stack and the growing number of other benefits that come along with that. All right, Adam, so we're back with you with the final question here. What's one non-money related investment that you would encourage folks to consider adopting?
You know, that's a great question. I think the best investors out there are the ones that are able to have something that allows them to completely escape investing, that get a complete reset and come back and with a fresh, clean slate. To me, that's physical wellness. That's working out. That's even if that means going for a walk every day for 20, 30 minutes, doing something that you can completely, you know, put your music on, go for a walk, go to the gym, and do something where you can just escape. And you'll be surprised how when you come back to work or investing or whatever you may be doing, how much better you honestly, how much more clear you think, and how much better your performance becomes because you had that opportunity to kind of reset. So more is not always better when it comes to investing.
I completely, as folks who watch this channel often know, completely agree and reinforce what you said. There's the old, I'm trying to remember who said it back during Roman times, but sound mind, sound body, right? What you're talking about is an investment that not only clears up your mind and helps you make better decisions and freshens how you think, But at the same time, you're increasing your longevity and your quality of life by, you know, doing something good in terms of your physical maintenance. So 100% agree. I do this. That's a huge part of my daily routine. So I'm right there with you, brother. Adam, thanks so much. Really appreciate you coming on the program. Great to have you here for your first appearance on Thoughtful Money. Looking forward to many more in the future. Thanks so much for taking the time to do this.
Thanks, Adam. It's great to be here. I love what you guys are doing.
Thanks. We're right back at you, buddy. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.